So that, I think, is the perfect segue for our first plenary speaker. We've started a new initiative as of last year where we want to invite a less, not less established, because you are established, obviously, but we've got these... I am so good at this, honestly. We've got the incredible contribution. We often have established professors delivering plenaries, but actually sometimes what's more, what can be really exciting is encouraging new research and people who are less established in their careers and developing their careers to express and share their work. And so that's something we want to do and what's something we wanted to do as a committee. And so we have invited and are absolutely delighted that Amy has accepted Amy Chandler, Dr. Amy Chandler, to do our opening plenary. Amy is currently a Chancellor's Fellow in Health through Arts, Design and Humanities in the School of Health and Health and Social Science at the University of Edinburgh, and has held positions at the University of Lincoln and in the Population Studies at Edinburgh University as well. She has publications in Social Theory and Health, Sociological Review, Journal of Gender Studies and the BMJ, to name just a few, has received funding from the Wellcome Trust, the Samaritans, the ESRC, as well as a collection of Scottish funders. Her book, Self-Injury, Medicine and Society, Authentic Bodies, has won two prizes. In 2017, the Phil Abrams Memorial Prize, and in 2018, the Foundation of Sociology and Illness Prize, and that was awarded here at MedSoc last year, so it seems incredibly fitting that we should invite her to talk on her research on, that is focused on self-injury, mental health, eating disorders, and psychotropic drug use. To open the 51st conference, and I'm going to stop embarrassing myself and invite you to deliver your talk. I don't want to intrude on it any further, so if I can welcome Dr. Amy Chandler.
Okay, I can now embarrass myself, so let's see how that gets me. All right, thank you for inviting me, it really is a very ridiculous honour, to be honest, to be giving a plenary at MedSoc, which I've been coming to for a long time, since I was not even a proper researcher, still a PhD student. So this is very exciting, and I'm very pleased that the committee decided to offer this opportunity for early career researchers. I hope I don't make a complete mess of it and you never do it again. Let's see. The title of my talk then is Authentic Bodies in Mental Health, and as is traditional, I have altered somewhat what I'm going to deliver compared to the abstract. So I'm going to kind of talk through my abstract a little bit and just point to the changes. So in this plenary presentation, I'm going to be drawing quite a lot on my own research on self-injury, as well as a very small amount on the work of other scholars working on mental health and the body, in order to attempt to craft a story about the role of authenticity and medicine in understanding mental health. I'm going to be suggesting that a range of embodied practices, which are often tied to mental health, so things like self-injury, which I've spent a huge amount of my early career researching, but also eating disorders and the consumption of psychotropic drugs, the way in which these practices enroll, rely on, and indeed enact particular cultural understandings of bodies. And I think that medicine, which we're all concerned with in different ways, both medical practice and research can be seen as crucial in shaping these. Authenticity emerges as well as a key theme in how medical knowledge and lay accounts regarding these practices are constructed. And so in this talk, I'm going to be trying to kind of talk through some of these things, as well as towards the end, briefly addressing some of the tensions and challenges of doing qualitative research in this area, and especially how that relates to authenticity, to the claims that we're making, and also to our position as researchers, and especially researchers such as myself who share the experiences that we are researching. So I'm going to be kind of grounding my talk by addressing a number of kind of related questions in relation to this broad idea of authentic bodies in mental health. And as I said, a lot of this draws on the work that's in the book that won all the awards and that hopefully I'll represent somehow here, and honestly it's written better than I'll probably speak it now. Addresses issues around authenticity and bodies in mental health by asking what do we mean by mental health, and hopefully, the reason I kind of tag this will become clear, and it's probably to some of you very obvious anyway, but where are bodies in mental health and what role do they play in how we make sense of or authenticate our mental health experiences, and how we're responded to by carers and those around us? How and in what ways is mental health embodied and bodily? How, to what extent, are bodies mental? And then, again, towards the end, I'll be thinking about authenticity, how we study distress authentically, and what role qualitative research might or might not play in that. Okay, so before I go into the talk proper, I wanted to put a brief note on imposter syndrome. This is a taxidermied fox, which I've chosen to depict how I feel at the moment. So this fox is trying, in my view, to look like a fox, trying to be a fox without not really knowing what a fox is. And doing an early career plenary, this is kind of how I feel at the moment. I'm trying to do a plenary presentation, but I don't have a massive career to draw on. I've only got 9 years or so. So I'm feeling imposter syndrome at the moment. And I've been kind of assured and sort of supported in doing this by engaging with the work of my colleague and friend, Maddie Breeze, who's working on imposter syndrome and thinking it through, drawing on Anna Svetovich's theories around emotions as public feelings or depression as public feeling. Maddie's been looking at imposter syndrome as public feeling. And so this has been very reassuring for me in terms of thinking about how our feelings are embodied, but also shaped by the social, political, and cultural context that we're in. So in this awesome book chapter, she writes about how our feelings of imposter syndrome are produced, and we should resist feeling these individual feelings, and we need to cope with them and look at how they are being produced by the societies we're in. But she also, helpfully for my purposes, talks about authenticity and about imposter syndrome as an experience of feeling inauthentic, and that we shouldn't be here, we're not doing it right. And so I'm kind of putting that out there. I'm feeling terrible, be kind. That's what I look like inside. Okay. So, to the proper subject matter, away from taxidermied foxes. So in terms of thinking about self-harm, the most of what I'm going to talk about for the first part of this talk is going to be around self-injury and self-harm, because that's what I've spent most of my time researching, and that's what the book is about. And I came to the area of medical sociology through self-harm, through my experiences and through trying to theorise my own experiences through sociology, which I discovered and fell in love with. But when I started on this path, I was immediately struck by a tension in the literature, both sociological and clinical, that I was trying to engage with in understanding self-harm, which is that I was interested in self-harm when it was being framed as a mental health issue, and certainly my own experiences in mental health services tagged it in that way as well. But the way in which mental health is framed and discussed is often, very interestingly and curiously, rather disembodied. So how then could I engage with this when I was interested in something which for me had always been utterly bodily? For me, the body was always a starting point with self-injury. Self-harm was bodied, but my self-harm body was being treated as mentally ill. So what was going on here? And as you'll see from the bottom of the slide, I drew and found a lot of comfort in the work of scholars such as Williams and Bendelow and Jillian's later work in thinking about this in terms of mind-body dualisms and the way in which we respond to and understand our own health being shaped by cultural and social ideas about what bodies are, about what minds are, about emotions, and about the relationships between the two. And this existence of dualisms emerged very strongly in the work that I've done on self-injury, and so we'll see what happens with that. So this quote here is from one of the interviews that I did as part of my doctoral research, which involved interviewing 12 people, not many, who had experience with self-injury, and I did two interviews with each of them, and these were narrative, open-ended, life story interviews, where a lot of it was very open. They knew that I had also self-injured, and we shared a lot, and we spent a lot of time, as you can see in the kind of quote there, I'll read it out for those of you that don't want to read, tentativeness and difficulty actually in articulating and trying to make sense together of what we were of this topic, self-injury, what was it? So Frances, one of the interviewees, said, you know, I was worried that I was implicitly, well, nobody had ever told me about, you know, no one had ever actually said to me, people who self-harm are nutters. But that was sort of like the implicit thing. If you do it, then you've got problems. You know, like, I didn't really feel like I had big problems. But there I was sort of, you know, cutting and burning myself. So that's what concerned me, was that, what does it mean? Am I actually a nutter, but I didn't know, sort of thing? And what you can see, or what I see in Frances's quote, you may disagree with me, is that there's a concern here about the realness of self-injury, actually, of what it means, what does it represent? Does it represent a real mental health problem, especially when I don't feel like I've got big problems? And this can be seen across a number of the other interviews, both in this study and in later studies that I've done, both with other people who've self-harmed and with general practitioners. There's a lot of kind of concern about what self-injury is. is it a mental health problem or is it just situational? Is it a fashion or a fad? So there are early concerns that endure about what self-harm is, what it represents and what its relationship is to mental illness. And what's also implicit here, although not a strong feature of Francis's story, is the role of agency and the difference that self-injury has and shares, I think, with eating disorders and with substance use perhaps, which is that it becomes, when we're thinking about bodily practices that involve us doing things with our bodies, there's a difference here between this and other types of mental illness that may, or mental health problems that may, we might not do to ourselves. So agency becomes a feature. And the issue of agency and authenticity I'll return to as we go forwards. Bodies are present also then in Francis's account. Body, the practices are bodily that he's talking about. He cuts himself and what does this mean? He might be a nutter because of the things that he does to his body. So where are bodies in self-injury? Well, it will come as no surprise that from my perspective, bodies are everywhere in self-injury. They're all over the place. It is a practice that involves the body in visceral, visible, and sometimes bloody ways. But the body is also there in how self-injury is made sense of and understood. And although it's frequently framed as a mental health problem, the body is there when self-injury is made sense of and explained to others. So we can see this in the role of sensation and in these kind of explanatory accounts that we have on the slide here, which is a very common way in which self-injury is narrated or explained or justified to other people. So that's an idea, it's a way of transforming emotional pain into physical pain or masking emotional pain with physical pain. And you see this in the quote from Harriet, one of the interviewees in the first study. She said, I was hurting so much, but I couldn't express that pain. I couldn't understand it. I could see the scars on my arm, and I could understand that. It's kind of like a way of masking this other pain. You forget about the other pain you're in because you're like, oh, my arm hurts, or whatever. And so we can see enrolled in here clearly a kind of a dualism. Do you know that this is, Harriet's talking about her body in separation from her emotions and from her feelings, but at the same time, dualism is subverted and unsettled because doing something to the body is affecting the mind, whether that's through masking or indeed transforming. And this kind of account comes up frequently in conversations with people who've self-injured. It's a common way that people, when I speak to them about my kind of subject area, will say, oh, well, people self-harm because of, you know, it's a way of coping, isn't it? Yeah, sure. So having a physical pain to deal with was easier than dealing with the pain you couldn't put a finger on. The physical pain was easier to deal with than the emotional pain. So this is from two different studies. This is a very kind of, it's a resilient narrative, a way of explaining self-injury to others. But it raises questions, though, about why physical pain is easier than emotional pain. And again, here we see dualism being enrolled, and it raises issues about why that is and what social and cultural contexts and meanings are supporting this idea that physical pain is somehow easier than emotional pain. And in part, in some of my writing, I've kind of connected this distinction to the kind of ongoing hierarchy within our health services, for instance, where physical health is often privileged over mental health. We have ongoing issues with cuts to services and lack of funding for mental health research, let alone treatment and care. Although there are ongoing campaigns to have mental health seen as just like having a broken leg, we know that when you have a broken leg, you are responded to very differently than if you attend A&E, for instance, with a mental health crisis. There are differences, and these are supported by structural kind of forces. But also, what I would suggest is that one of the reasons that physical pain is easier than emotional pain is that it is easier to prove. And this is the relation, this is how I'm tying this to authenticity, is that physical pain is easier to authenticate. And you see this across the accounts, that physical pain is easier to deal with, but it also shows something to the self or to others that I am actually in pain. You can see it. Whereas if I'm feeling bad, I can talk about it, or maybe I can't talk about it actually. But either way, I might not be believed. Pain and the body and authenticity emerge, though, in different ways, in the clinic, for instance. And so the kind of narrative of self-injury being a way of transforming emotional pain into physical pain contradicts another very common narrative or way of understanding or explaining self-injury, which is that self-injury doesn't actually hurt. So it's a way of transforming emotional pain into physical pain, but also people who self-injure may have, and according to some clinical work, may have biological differences, which mean that their level, their pain thresholds differ from those who don't self-injure. So this is interesting, and is interesting in terms of how medicine kind of produces self-injured bodies in different ways from how we might see them outside of the clinic. So the paper there is one of a series of kind of clinical papers which have attempted in different ways to kind of try and identify and find pain or lack of pain in self-injured bodies. And in particular, there's a lot of focus on attempting to mark differences between bodies of people who've been diagnosed with borderline personality disorder and those who have not, or those who have attempted suicide at the bottom there, or and those who have not. And they found, you know, in clinical kind of experimental settings, differences in the pain threshold. But of course, from a sociological perspective, these kinds of approaches ignore all of the fleshy, intimate, and emotional contexts in which self-injury is normally practiced. And Anna, speaking in 2007, was one of the people that I've spoken to who very much felt that self-injury didn't hurt, actually, as much as you would expect, and that there was some differences between her and somebody who didn't self-injure. And in one of our interviews in 2007, she said, there's some difference, I think, in the pain threshold, you know, because if you were sitting like now, calm, kind of fine, to take a razor blade to your arm or whatever, I bet you wouldn't be able to do it. And for Anna, the difference was not about kind of the level of kind of pain hormones in her body or anything like this. It was about the emotional context and the emotional state that she might be in when she harmed herself. And for Anna, in Anna's particular case, this was tied to experiences of being in the home and in a busy environment. Quite different from a clinic. The idea of pain and self-injury in the body also becomes kind of unsettled when we're thinking of it as a clinical or kind of biomedical production. When we look at other accounts which talk about self-injury not hurting, and actually more than that, it might actually feel kind of nice. And this raises and links issues around how we understand pain, not as a kind of biomedical, kind of mechanical thing that happens, but it's shaped by cultural contexts. And similar work that's looked at people in BDSM relationships has also unsettled this idea of a clear-cut difference between pain and pleasure. So how does self-injury feel? Well, fucking great, according to Angelo, who took part in a study in 2014, which looked at accounts and understandings of much younger people, aged 13 to 16. Wonderful, like bubbles, this is Reese talking about burning herself with a cigarette, or a rush, and so you have two, this kind of came up, the same words, a rush, is that thing just, honestly, from Justin in 2007, and Greta writing many years later in 2014. So where are bodies in self-injury? Here they are again. Bodies are also present in self-injury as a way of potentially communicating, as a cry for help. But these kinds of accounts happen and exist alongside other kind of contradictory arguments that self-injury should be hidden. And indeed, when self-injured bodies are being narrated and talked about in terms of being a way of communicating to others how I'm feeling, of proving, perhaps, of authenticating pain to others, it's difficult to provide those kinds of accounts directly. So Callie, right in 2014, and Millie, I spoke to in 2007, provided a very, very similar account of this, saying, I wanted attention, I was depressed, I wanted to die, and having cut some of my skin was sort of a subconscious cry for help, even though I didn't know it. Millie writes, spoke also of seeking attention subconsciously. So there's very much a kind of, in terms of thinking about will and our involvement and our agency in this, both Callie and Millie produced accounts where they dismissed that, so they were self-injuring to communicate, to seek help, but not consciously. And why can't we do it consciously? Well, because if you self-harm, you show other people, that's not so good. So where are bodies in self-injury? They have to be hidden. So Gita, writing in 2014, again, she was one of the younger participants in the later study, wrote that although there are a few vile people who harm for attention, most self-harmers really do have problems. And this brief excerpt is doing a lot of work. So quite clearly, those who harm for attention, whose wounds, whose injuries are visible, are vile, so it's not so good. And again, Gita is not alone in that. There were lots of accounts like this, but this was certainly one among a few. But also the suggestion that people who self-harm and hide it, most self-harmers, most of us, really do have problems. And so in order to practice self-harm authentically, to really have problems, it has to be hidden, even while it might be trying to prove that you're in pain. So Jay, who was again part of that later study, he was age 16 when I spoke with him and took part in an in-depth interview, spoke really, really cleverly, I thought, about this. I was very impressed with Jay's kind of level of reflexivity. But she said, I've always felt under pressure to hide the cuts and the scars because it was something you had to do. I felt like if I chose to take off a cardigan or a sweatshirt because it was boiling hot, I was choosing to reveal cuts underneath, and that was attention seeking, etc. She said, which is obviously complete bullshit, but it was still a fear. So we can be aware of these impulses and the problems around them, but it still shapes how we move through the world with self-injured bodies. So, how do we navigate the world when self-injured bodies are marked in these different and potentially problematic ways? We may be attention-seeking, we may be inauthentic, we might not really be ill. Well, one of the ways in which it's kind of defended against is to claim mental illness, actually, and to authenticate our practice of self-injury by saying that we are mentally ill, we couldn't help it. So again, this is reproduced frequently across the studies that I've done. Leanne says behind self-harm is usually a mental illness. Jodie, I was living with undiagnosed bipolar and social anxiety disorder. And these attachments to kind of psychiatric labels were fairly common in the 2014 study. And this can be seen as a move, I think, from the body that's self-injured to the mind, but then back to the body, because we know through the work of Nicholas Rhodes, Simone Fulagar and others, that the way in which mental illness is understood now is increasingly bodily, biomedical, neurochemical. And we see this also in accounts of people who self-injure, and particularly through the idea of the endorphin release. So this came up a lot in the 2014 study. So Dean wrote, I self-harm because I like to see blood flow from my body, it makes me happy, endorphin release. The endorphins also help and make me feel somewhat excited afterwards. The scars, the blood, the cuts are all part of the reason. And for Nino, this is dopamine. And these all sorts of kind of technical terms are being used to explain why we might self-injure. But what's interesting, I think, is that alongside these neurochemical kind of arguments or justifications for self-injury, the body is also there in other ways. So there is blood. There is something about the visuality and the sensation of hurting ourselves or the scars that might be left afterwards, which is part of the attraction. But endorphins, nonetheless, are there. And we can see this elsewhere. Endorphins are not kind of, we don't just know about endorphins, we have to learn about them somewhere, right? So this is an excerpt from a website which has actually been around for a number of years. I'm almost certain, although don't quote me on this bit, it might not be true, that this website or something like it was around in the very late 1990s when I first got access to the internet and found stuff on self-injury. And so here we have this authoritative statement. The brain releases substances called endorphins, which has similar effects to morphine, would that it did, that work as painkillers when you hurt yourself. Endorphins can also cause a pleasant physical sensation and can become addictive, so people self-injure to produce feelings of euphoria. And so we can see these kinds of narratives, they circulate, they're taken on, they're used in different ways, they're used alongside other kinds of arguments. Indeed. So in this quote from Rose and Abu Raked, we can start to think about this more broadly. And so in their work around neuroscience and the way in which ideas about brain sciences have started to shape and change how we respond to ourselves, change what things we do with our bodies maybe, they write, we can extend our hopes and fears over our biomedical bodies to that special organ of the brain. We act upon the brain as on the body to reform, cure, or improve ourselves and have a new register to understand, speak, and act upon ourselves and on others as the kinds of beings whose characteristics are shaped by neurobiology. And I think with these accounts about endorphins and how we might kind of enroll and use those as ways of justifying, explaining, or understanding our practice of self-injury, we can see people taking this on for themselves, acting on their bodies in order to enact changes in their brain to make themselves happy, to induce feelings of calm. But this is in a wider context, which Rose addresses, and which Simone Fulagar has also talked about in her work on antidepressant medication use among women. So she writes, in relation to health, patients are no longer passive recipients of expertise. They're urged to become active, responsible consumers of medical services, products, and pharmaceuticals. These products have emerged out of the broader transformation of knowledge within biocapitalism, science, and the clinical encounter to profoundly change the way we imagine and relate to our biological selves at the molecular level. So I think this is really interesting and useful in terms of thinking about self-injury, because self-injury draws on these kinds of narratives of neurochemicals that are enacted and used in biocapitalism, But it involves practices that are carried out largely away from kind of capitalist networks and markets. To quote somebody who also took part in the 2014 research when asked to reflect on differences between self-injury, alcohol use and drug use, their response was, well, self-injury is free. Self-injury is indeed free, mostly, and it can be carried out away from these kinds of markets, but nonetheless it does draw on the narratives that are kind of enacted and enrolled through these markets. It's not entirely innocent and pure, although we might like to think sometimes it is. So I'm going to move a little bit of a key change away from accounts about self-injury per se to how self-injury is narrated in other types of texts through different types of words from different types of people, in this case clinical practitioners and researchers writing in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of the American Psychiatric Association. In the book, I spend quite a lot of time going on about the DSM criteria for non-suicidal self-injury because it is fascinating. I'm going to talk through just a little bit of it now to give some of you a flavour of it. There are wider debates within sociology and self-injury about whether or not self-injury is medical, to which, what extent has it been medicalised or demedicalised. Sociologists based in the US, Adler and Adler, have argued that it has become demedicalised. You know, people are, you know, doing it outside of clinical context without psychiatric diagnosis. In some cases, it is a fashion or a fad. However, 2 years after they published a book claiming that, it appeared in the DSM-5, suggesting that there are concerted efforts to medicalise self-injury. Whether or not they're successful or not is another matter. So in the DSM-5, a proposed diagnostic criteria of non-suicidal self-injury was provided, which was really interesting and contradictory, but also involves bodies and authenticity in interesting ways. So this is all direct quotes from the DSM criteria. So they say the essential feature of non-suicidal self-injury is that the individual repeatedly inflicts shallow yet painful injuries to the surface of their body. They write a single session of injury might involve a series of superficial parallel cuts separated by 1 or 2 centimetres on a visible or accessible location. I can tell you from experience it's quite hard to injure yourself in an inaccessible location, but thank you for the clarification, DSM. The resulting cuts will often bleed and will often leave a characteristic pattern of scars. So the body is here, and you can see the people that have written this clearly do have experience with people who have self-injured and probably spoken to them and probably offered them care. But there's some interesting contradictions. So they kind of have this veneer of this is really kind of very precise and you need this is what you need to look for. But there's contradictions here which are interesting. These are repeatedly shallow injuries. They often leave, but might not always, but they will eventually leave a characteristic pattern of scars. And scarring and wounds and wound severity are very important when you speak to people who self-injure, actually, about how authentic their practice is. But here we have superficial, shallow injuries that might leave scars. Again, plenty of injuries caused by self-injury do not scar at all. But yeah, whatever. Thank you, dear sir. So, other ways in which the body is evident in the DSM, though, is in the form of a concern with neuroscience. Now, there is clinical work on this, but it's really difficult. It often involves very small samples, attempts to extract kind of hormonal kind of evidence from lumbar punctures. I'm not a medical person, clearly, but it's difficult. It involves small samples, and it often involves clinical samples contrasting people with borderline personality disorder diagnoses and those who don't. And so this is what the DSM says with a lot of authority, that there are differences in the involvement of different neurotransmitter systems between people diagnosed with BPD and those who are not. But these will not be apparent on clinical examination. So which raises questions about why this is necessary then in a diagnostic manual, but nonetheless, it is still there. And it suggests something, I think, about what is happening with this attempt to medicalise self-injury, to formalise it, and that it's not enough that we have shallow injuries that might bleed and might scar. There has to be a search for something more, something deeper that causes us to do these things in different ways. So in terms of thinking this through, the work of being hacking, I think, is particularly useful, both in terms of thinking about what's happening when these kind of narratives travel and transfer themselves between texts like the DSM, internet sites which are drawing on clinical research, and then circulated and reused by people who self-injure. So hacking, writing in 2006, says we think of these kinds of people, perhaps people who self-injure, as definite classes defined by definite properties, and you have this in the DSM as a clear attempt to define a class of people. As we get to know more about these properties, though, we'll be able to control, help, change, or emulate better. But hacking rights, it's not quite like that. They're moving targets, and we see this clearly with this. Our investigations interact with them. People read stuff, they draw on those narratives, and they repurpose them for their own needs. Hacking rights, and since they are changed, they're not quite the same kind of people as before. The target has moved. Hacking causes the looping effect, and sometimes our sciences, and I think Hacking's work is useful here because he includes sociology in this, yeah, and you're probably all very aware of this. So we're not innocent here, we can make people. So sometimes our sciences create kinds of people that in a certain sense didn't exist before, and I call this making up people. And again, this is interesting in terms of thinking about authenticity and what it means to make up a diagnosis, to make up a practice, what it means to make up a self-injured body. So, this is the conclusion to part one of the presentation. Ready? So bodies emerge, I think, in self-injury as a focus, but the making up of bodies is not, to use Nicholas Rose's term, purely molar. Bodies are constructed in these accounts, increasingly perhaps, as biomedical or neurochemical entities, with acts of injury to the skin or elsewhere understood, for some at least, as acting on the brain or on our emotions via neurotransmitters or hormones or something like that, something that sounds technical. And I'd suggest that in part the use of these narratives to explain self-injury to others, as well as reflecting these broader trends that we see elsewhere towards kind of neuro-everything, also represent a way of legitimising or authenticating self-injury. In the face of claims that we see increasingly, especially given rising rates of self-harm and so on among young people, and especially young women, that self-injury is fashionable, or attention-seeking, or something that could be faked or copied, people who self-injure may be drawn then to draw on a technical or medical language to defend against this, to argue that self-injury is a real illness because it perhaps has a biological basis. Okay. This is the part of the talk that I wanted to have more to say about, but ran out of time, so I'm apologising. This needs more work, and I'm not doing it. In terms of what I've been talking about the role of bodies, understandings of kind of clinical framings of what biology is, what bodies are, how culture and society frames and shapes what bodies are, and how that relates to authenticity and mental health, I think there are kind of wider implications away from self-injury itself, which otherwise might be seen as a bit of a niche topic. So one of the kind of potential parallel movements that I flagged at the start of the talk is around thinking about eating disorders. And particularly here, the role of agency and will in thinking about mental health. I'm drawing particularly here in thinking about this on a paper published back in 2010 by Pearson Picard. I don't know if anybody else would have read this, but it's a fascinating paper called Finding the Will to Recover, Philosophical Perspectives on Agency and the Sick Role. And in this paper, they use self-harm and eating disorders and substance use as examples to suggest that actually in psychiatric and mental health treatment, there should be more acknowledgement that people might have some willpower, might actually be able to make a decision and change their behaviour. And I found this really fascinating and interesting, especially in terms of thinking about practices like self-injury and like some kinds of disordered eating, which do involve us doing things, making decisions and doing practices that aren't entirely accidental. They don't happen to us. It is different from other things, like a broken leg. Maybe not a broken leg, you could actually break your own leg. Like cancer, we'll use that. So there are differences here, and I think it is important to take those seriously, but that then raises these issues and these tensions that emerge in my research with people who self-injured, and in the research of others, including Lauren O'Connell, who presented earlier on today, and who I've spoken with about this, and I cannot wait till she actually publishes properly her PhD when it's finished, it's awesome, about the way in which this raises real questions about whether we're really ill, whether we could just stop it, and whether or not something happens to us or we just did it to ourselves. And authenticity is at stake here, and that is important. It can have real implications for our social relationships with carers, with our family, and with our friends. So where are bodies here? Well, they might be very active rather than passive, and in some cases they may indeed be powerful. Okay, so the other parallel movement is in terms of psychotropic drug treatments, which Jen suggested I had done research on. I haven't done any research on psychotropic drug treatments specifically, but there are some really interesting resonances here, which, especially in terms of my early thinking around authenticity and self-injury, I drew on particularly the work of Stepniski, who was writing about authenticity in relation to mental health treatments in 2007. But Fulagar and O'Brien wrote in 2012, write about this in relation to their work around antidepressant treatments and the experiences of women with this. And women's accounts of how to navigate antidepressant treatments and who they were, their self. So who am I as a woman in relation to my depression, and who am I to become through antidepressant use? Is depression me, or is it just the illness? What's the separation there? There's a real authenticity, even though it's not clearly named, is a tension here. There's a tension in the accounts of trying to kind of navigate what's happening when we seek help for depression, when we identify ourselves as depressed. Do we try and take antidepressants to find the real me, or are we kind of covering up and becoming somebody different and somebody else, an emotionless zombie? What's going on with that? And Stepniski draws on similar kind of interviews with people about their antidepressant use, but also kind of makes links to kind of broader issues. And again, we have the idea of biocapitalism and looking at how in early antidepressant kind of medication adverts, they were sold very much on this promise of authenticity. So we're well Butrin adverts that he cites that is sold to people as being able to help them feel like themselves again. So again, we have this authenticity is present here, but so are bodies in relation to mental health treatment. And so I think, again, there are broader connections here to make, which I have not done a great job of. Okay, so in the final few minutes, I want to talk a little bit about authenticity in relation to qualitative research, and especially qualitative research in relation to mental health, and perhaps especially, depending on where my rambling takes me, qualitative research that's carried out by somebody who shares the experience that they are researching. Okay, so in particular, this is informed by some of the work that I've been doing recently in working with policymakers and trying to work with them on thinking about policies around self-harm and suicide, and how to situate myself as a researcher who draws on qualitative research. And often in these kind of spaces where I'm working with practitioners and policymakers, my work is seen as really exciting. It gives a voice. It gives good stories to the problem that's being studied and attempted to, you know, kind of respond to. And there's an increasingly acceptance and, you know, acknowledgement that lived experience, especially in mental health treatments and indeed more widely, needs to be central to what policymakers do, to how policies are developed. But how do we do this as qualitative researchers, especially perhaps sociological qualitative researchers, where we know that the accounts that we get are not the truth? Yeah, they're situated, they are contested, they are produced in particular contexts, they're shaped by the stories that it's possible to tell. We're interested in the silences as much as what is said. And so this raises real questions, I think, about the status of the knowledge that we're creating through qualitative research, especially in the mental health realm. This is vulnerable knowledge because these are partial accounts that are constructed and constituted in different ways, and yet they are often taken as a sign and a marker of authenticity. This is the authentic voice, and these are authentic stories. So there's a potential, I think, for qualitative work in this field to be co-opted in ways that are uncomfortable. And if somebody has questions or actually comments or suggestions about how to navigate that, I would be welcome, happy to hear them. But qualitative research in this field of thinking about mental health, but also thinking about mental health in relation to embodiment, raises other challenges and limits, which I'm increasingly coming up against and trying to find different ways of navigating. And this has involved me dabbling in arts-based methods and trying to look at different ways of exploring how people might experience mental health and their bodies. Because when we ask people to account for things, and I'm supremely conscious of this when I'm speaking to people, other people who have self-injured and asking them to tell me how it was, that I know I can't say how it was. I've only got so many words that I can use to say it, and I might tell a different story one day to a different person another day. So there are limits to narrative, qualitative interviews and text-based work. So at the moment, I'm working through the analysis of a small pilot project which used art as a way to try and open up different types of conversations to explore meanings and understandings of self-harm in different ways, without words, perhaps. I don't have findings for that bit. But what I will say is that it seems to be working. It has been absolutely fascinating, amazing, weird, what kinds of different conversations have been enabled by the space that having art and just stopping talking for a bit has enabled. And I've got a brief interlude, which involves introducing you to some of that and how it works, through Amber's Brews. So this is a piece of work produced in one of a series of workshops that I did with a group of young people who had experience of self-harm, where we met together over 6 weeks, made art together, and talked about different understandings of self-harm. So Amber's Brews, she spent a long time drawing, and then we spoke about it afterwards. And this was in relation to the way in which her bruised body, which was self-inflicted, was often read differently by different people. People expected that a bruise was made by somebody else. They didn't expect it was made by her. And we talked about how cuts might be less equivocal. They're more obvious. That's definitely self-harm, whereas a bruise isn't. And so this raised issues about how our bodies are read differently. And again, it raises issues about the status of knowledge, the status of the accounts that we produce, and how they're read in different ways. And also for me, as a researcher who has lived experience and a difficult relationship with naming that in different ways, it also raises issues about how I'm read. And again, in policy and practice arenas, this is difficult because I'm read as, oh, well, I could be a researcher with lived experience. I could be a survivor researcher. I don't necessarily claim either of those things. And how do I navigate that kind of process authentically, but at the same time, with a body that might be read in different ways, that has visible scars? So, conclusions. Bodies, I think, should be in sociological research addressing mental health, and they are certainly there anyway, but through my own work on self-injury, what I have found is that dualisms are utterly resilient, both in my analysis sometimes, but certainly in the accounts of participants, and I think working with and against that is really important, but it's also something to be attended to. I still read papers about self-injury that don't mention bodies, and it's really weird. Stop it. Okay. but we need to understand these bodies in social and cultural contexts and to think about why it is that authenticity, having an authentic body and authentic mental illness, is so important. Stepnitsky's work started to touch on this back in 2007, and there's probably stuff that I don't know about that addresses this in more carefully and cleverly than I have today. But I think the kind of valorisation of authenticity is something that we could do more to trouble, and particularly through our qualitative work, by not reifying it. Medicine as culture. Medicine is culture, it's in culture, it's shaped by culture, and I think this work has really tried to show different ways in which that is the case. Qualitative research is vital, but as I said, we need to be so wary that our analysis is not being co-opted as a representation of authentic voices and authentic people. And qualitative research is vital, but words have limits when we're dealing, especially with bodies and feelings. And so I think there is so much scope that's already been done, being done by many other people in much better ways than me, that are using kind of more creative approaches that don't rely so much on words. So that's my final slide. I'll leave you with my props. Thank you.